Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
It's nice to see all of you here. It is trying very sincerely to be spring. I think we should encourage it. So this morning, I will be talking to you about pilgrimage. My confession is that this is actually a talk I wrote quite some time ago, several months ago, and I'm just now getting around to delivering it. So I reviewed what I had written yesterday and spent some time with it, and then I critiqued my own material, which we're very fond of doing. Some of it I liked and some of it I changed. But I want to talk about pilgrimage because it has a large role in Buddhist history and practice. It certainly has a role in Zen practice. And personally, it was at the forefront of my mind for several months because I helped to lead pilgrimage for about 20 folks to Ireland this past fall. We spent a couple of weeks in Ireland. And now I'm starting to slowly work on prep for another pilgrimage that I'm helping to lead this coming year to South Africa. And they involve a huge amount of preparation, not only writing and teachings and material, but also just logistical stuff. It's like planning 5 weddings at once kind of a thing, just loads and loads of details. So they have a tendency to kind of eclipse your whole life when you're working with them in that way. So they were on my mind, and I thought, well, write about what you know. So that's what I knew. As I was spending time with the material, it kind of occurred to me that most of the stuff that pilgrimage has taught me and most of the stuff that it kind of churns up for people is really applicable to daily life. And, of course, everything we do here is always about how do we pull practice? How do we pull our Zen study into our daily life, right? How can it ease our experience? I'll start by just defining the way I'm using the word pilgrimage, and then I'll talk about the three things that the three elements that I found in it. For those of you who are new to the idea of pilgrimage, or newer, it's not unusual for the idea of an intentional journeying or sacred travel. Most of the faith traditions have some version of this. And in the Buddhist world, there are a lot of folks who make, I suppose, what they would call a pilgrimage to the Bodhi tree, the tree under which the Buddha was enlightened, or to see the Buddha's birthplace. Or I've always had fantasies about going to Aheiji, Dogen's temple in Japan, or Katagiri's home temple. And it's the type of journeying we do that has a very deep intentionality around it. And in that way, it varies, or it differs from just, travel or sightseeing, right? Because the point of sightseeing is to see, oh, that's cool. You get your picture, awesome, add it to the album. That's cool. Travel can be the same way. Travel, the intention usually is to go to someplace, right? So this morning I traveled from Eden Prairie to Zen Center. Pilgrimage is really more about transformation, is the way I'm going to talk about it today. That it's really less about the destination and more about what the destination says about us, what it can teach us, how it can change us. So that's the way I'm using the word today. And as I mentioned, it has a place and a history in Zen practice. In both China and Japan, there would be a time in which it would not be uncommon for a student to leave their home temple or their monastery and travel for a time. And sometimes there'd be a real specific reason. There's something that's not being answered, something that's burning in them that they can't seem to unwind with that teacher at that place, and so they head off to see if somebody else can help them clarify it. Sometimes maybe not a burning question, but maybe more of just wanting to ripen ripen their understanding, ripen their practice by traveling, meeting other people, hearing teachings from other teachers. As we all know, travel has a way of being very unpredictable. So it's kind of a way of like saying, I want to take this availability into the world and sort of see what happens. Because we really don't know what we're in for. I mean, we really like to think we know what we're in for, but we don't. And with pilgrimage especially, you really do have a feeling of, I'm just offering myself up here, and we'll see. We'll see what happens. So it has a history. It has a history in this practice. And so today I'm going to propose that it has three elements. The first is don't know mind or beginner's mind. That's very common teaching in Zen. For those of us who did this past practice period together, this was a place we came back to over and over. This is a very, very, very important teaching in Zen practice, starting from a place of being willing to let go of our preconceptions about our life and our experience and sort of start fresh, kind of a blank slate, shaking the etch-a-sketch of your mind. The second element is not taking shelter or a radical sense of poverty. And this is about the way we tend to hang on to and grab on to and try to surround ourselves with things that essentially insulate us from suffering. Comfort, right? Wanting to keep safe. And the third element is connection. So I'm going to spend most of my time today talking about the second one, about not taking shelter. But I think we need all three. So, the history of pilgrimage in Buddhism starts all the way at the beginning, 2,500 years ago, with the Prince Siddhartha, the man who would become the Buddha, right? When he has his realization that everything he has, all of his money and his comfort, his family, his wife, his child, his power, notoriety, do not protect him from sickness, old age, and death. He leaves, and he doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't necessarily have even a specific idea of what it is he's looking for, other than, I want to find the fundamental, I want to clarify the fundamental matter, how do we work with life and death? The big question, right? Is there a solution to the problem of human suffering? That's really what motivates him. And so in his case, according to the story, the pilgrimage is very literal. He leaves everything. Right, he abandons everything and heads out, and he doesn't have a destination. He just starts working with teachers, the ones that he meets. What do you have to teach me? Do their practice. When he senses that he's learned what he can learn or has exhausted that possibility, he moves on to the next one. Right. The only destination for him is, I guess, realization, freedom. Right, and he doesn't know if he'll ever get there, but that's the sense. Right, that's the sense of it. So when I read that story, I think he does go through all three of the elements of pilgrimage. I think he does start off. It seems very clear to me, actually, that he starts off with not knowing. And I think the first thing he unknows is the idea that he had, that so many of us have, that comfort will protect us from suffering. Right? And That's the myth of acquisition, and we're all swimming in the sea of the myth of acquisition in this culture, especially now. You know, we all have that so much. Somebody yesterday was telling me about new studies they're doing on something called hedonic adaptation. And I went, well, that's a big word. I should use that in a talk, because that would just sound impressive. And she said, yes, hedonic adaptation does sound impressive. And what it is, you know, hedonism is comfort, right, pleasure. And these studies they're doing, and of course I haven't read any of this, I'm repeating what she said, but it made perfect sense. I went, well, yeah, of course that's true. The thing that makes you comfortable for X amount of time, and then you need more of the same thing to continue to make you that comfortable, right? And I went, oh, it's just like addiction, you know. The one glass of wine that makes you feel relaxed and open at some point has to become two, and at some point has to become three. I went, oh, I get it. That's the way we're wired as human beings, right? So I get it. So the things we need to keep us comfortable, we have to continue to acquire. We have to continue to get more and more. So we see this in our own life. I always think of Christmas morning when I was a kid, and the thing that I wanted more than life itself, the toy that you want more than anything else, you get, and you're outrageously happy for, I don't know, a couple hours. If it was a really good toy, a couple days. If it was a really, really good toy, maybe a couple of weeks. But then it's just part of your experience field, and it's no longer interesting, and you need something else. So sort of how we're wired, I think. The Buddha taught that desire is limitless. It is the nature of the human being to continue to want. And I have always experienced that to be 100% true. It really doesn't stop, ever. So he had to unlearn that idea. He had to unlearn the idea that somehow if he stayed with his comfort and continued to acquire, he would be safe. That's a really brave act. That's a really brave act. To be willing to look, to be willing to be open, really involves a lot of not knowing. It really involves letting go. It really involves letting go of preconceptions. In fact, it's in my experience, it's actually less about the way you're looking or looking deeper or looking in a particular way. It seems more about just letting go of whatever ideas are in the way. Does that make sense? It's not about like learning a new special way of looking. It's like whatever the idea is in your head, just let it pass through, because it's going to be incomplete. It's not going to provide you a satisfaction. So when he stays in this state of not knowing for the 6 years that we say he traveled and learned, in current Zen practice, one of the ways we do, I think of this as pilgrimage. One of the ways we do pilgrimage together is retreat and sesshin. And so in this case, the pilgrimage isn't to a place, because we don't go anywhere. We like really do stay on this little black mat for a week at a time. In this case, the pilgrimage is about a period of time. So it's a little like the Native American vision quest. You know, you go to the top of the hill and you just stay there for a week. You don't do anything. You're not going to a place. You're spending time. The very same spirit, right? The very same spirit of just intentionality. What am I making myself available to? How might I change? What might I learn, right? And so we do this at Zen Center in retreat, and we also do it, I think, in a smaller way, but in just as important a way. Every time we sit zazen, we really don't know what's going to happen, do we? Does anybody know what's about to pop up? I mean, you really don't know, you know? And the process of zazen itself is always about, oh, I see how I'm wandering into my ideas and my agenda, and and you recognize that and you let it go, right? You go from your idea to back to not knowing. I'm just going to be with the field of my experience with no ideas about it. Just be available to it, right? That really does feel to me like a little pilgrimage, because, boy, sometimes that 40 minutes is really exciting and full of lots of characters and lots of wonderful feelings. And sometimes nobody particularly helpful shows up. And it's a little less comfortable. Definitely. Definitely moving into the unknown. You know. The other thing that I'll talk about a little bit with this not knowing is, you know, I was really aware when I was planning the pilgrimage, when I was helping to plan the pilgrimage to Ireland, and I'm aware of it now acutely with the one to South Africa, that we're calling it pilgrimage, which seems fair, but I'm very much aware of how privileged we are to be able to do what we're doing, that I assume will become excruciatingly obvious when we're in South Africa. You know, we're on pilgrimage. Oh, yes, the white suburbanites in the United States with hundreds of thousands of dollars have enough money to take an intentional journey. Isn't that sweet? I mention that only because when I was on a pilgrimage some years ago to France and Scotland, we were going to some sacred cathedrals there. They talked about, you know, these cathedrals were built in the Middle Ages, and pilgrimage, of course, has a huge place in the Christian tradition as well. And the people who made pilgrimages to these sites, as a rule, there's always exceptions, but as a rule went because they had no other option. It's the Middle Ages, the plague, Your child is dying. There's no such thing as a doctor who can do anything. What do? You have an idea in your head that there's a sacred place or a special person or maybe a blessing or maybe, right? The way they would have thought about this type of stuff. And you carry your child for hundreds of miles because it's all you really have as a hope, as an option. And that was the energy around that was dark and hard. I mean, there are crypts in the basement and these huge graveyards of people who didn't make it and huge graveyards of people who made it and then died, of course, because as beautiful as the cathedral is, it's not saving you from the plague. So there's something about... what it reminded me of is the way the Buddha did his. Because in a sense, the way I've always read that story was there was some degree of almost desperation to him leaving everything. I mean, you leave your money and your name and all your, you know, because you can't not do it. He's to some degree really propelled by suffering. You know, we would say he's drawn forward from his bodhicitta, his awakening mind, his desire to awaken. But a lot of that is recognizing what doesn't work, right? So being fueled by a certain amount of suffering makes a lot of sense to me. And I see it here too. I mean, I think a lot of people who come to spiritual practice are kind of pushed from behind by suffering, as opposed to drawn from the front by the promise of some great thing. Does that make sense? You know, I mean, during times of great difficulty in our life, we tend to go back to what's the most fundamental. And I would, in my personal case, I would say my spiritual path has been much more fueled by suffering than it has been to aspire to some lofty state, especially here at at least in my experience. If I was in it for the lofty state, I would have quit a long time ago. Not too lofty, thank goodness. But the gift of suffering, the gift of being driven by that is, and it is a gift, is that it makes us open. Right? That there's a really deep unknowing there. You know, what we do know is the suffering part. What we don't know is where we're going, who's going to help us, how it's going to turn out. We don't know. And there's an availability that comes with that. We become more able to entertain possibilities we wouldn't normally. That's one of the funny things about comfort is that it makes the world smaller, actually, doesn't it? Isn't that weird? Like, we want it and we need a certain amount of it, or else we're just in animal mode the whole time, and we need a certain amount, of course, of comfort. But too much of it becomes insulating and deadening, and the world actually gets kind of softer, smaller, what's the word I'm using? Kind of numb. There's a numbness that comes with that. And there's an availability and an openness that comes with being desperate. At least to some degree it does. So there's a great poem by... you guys know Basho, the famous Japanese haiku poet, and we use him a lot in Zen teaching. His companion, of course, Basho's practice was pilgrimage constantly. His whole life was essentially one big long travel. So he had no destination. He just traveled. That's the way it worked for him. His companion, during one of their journeys, they had spent a lot of his stories. If you haven't read Basho, do. It's easy to read, and it's very sweet, and... very deep and just really lovely, really, really lovely stuff. His companion wrote a poem after they had spent a difficult night together once. Under one roof, prostitute and monk, we all sleep together, moon in a field of clover. So normally, in Japan at that time, and I would say even now, monks and prostitutes don't spend time in the same place at the same time under one roof. They just don't, right? These are two completely different... And yet, because of the circumstances of pilgrimage, because of the circumstances of travel, sometimes, you know, all sorts of things are combined. We stay in strange places, we meet strange people, we become open to possibilities we normally wouldn't have. Right? So I'm imagining in this story, Sora being, normally I would never associate myself with somebody of such a low social status. But in this case, it's the only inn that there is available. And this is what we're doing. So we're all sharing space. And we eat together, and we get to know one another, and we even sleep under the same roof. So in a sense, he kind of has to unknow, at least for that night, all the rules of his monkhood in order to be there. There's something nice about that, I think. So the second element is... the second element of pilgrimage is not taking shelter. or what I'm calling radical poverty. So Tim has talked in the past, especially during retreat, about retreats having, and Zen practice itself having, a an ordeal component. That's the words he uses. An ordeal component. If it's too easy, nothing happens. If it's too hard, nothing happens. That there's that. It's always the middle way, right? That's part of the Buddha's initial teaching after his journey was too much asceticism, too much difficulty, not enough comfort, too much constriction. It doesn't work. On the other hand, the opposite spectrum, getting everything, complete comfort, complete indulgence. There's no traction there. It's kind of like the hell realms and the God and the heaven realms. Nothing gets done in those realms. You need to be in the human realm where it's a nice marriage of both, and you get what they say is a perfect mix of pleasure and difficulty, right? So in the human experience, things can actually get done. We actually have the impetus to practice, right? We have just enough suffering to fuel us, just enough comfort to kind of keep us sane, and you know, we have, this is the perfect scenario, right? According to traditional Buddhism, we are all in the perfect scenario for practice to become Buddhas. So he talks about a little bit of the ordeal component, and it is hugely important in intentional travel, in pilgrimage, and I think in Zen practice too, because our normal ideas, a lot of our normal ideas around comfort, is something that actually protects us from reality itself. You know, it starts off being, I want to feel good and not bad. And it ends up being, yeah, and I don't even want to watch the news. I don't want to know about that. Right? And there's a place for that too, but you can just see how it, at some point it becomes very me-focused, and how do I stay comfortable? And we come more and more divorced, actually, from reality. And in Buddhism we have the three treasures. Right, the three jewels, the three refuges. So this is not the traditional kind of refuge. We've talked a lot about the refuges here, so I won't spend too much time on them. But the three refuges are Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And these are not actually refuges that keep us in any way from reality or experience. It's quite the opposite. These are the things that take us toward our experience of reality, open us up even more, right? It isn't an insulating type of refuge at all. It's these are the three things that we need to help us open further, to be more available, to go deeper into being awake and alive. So we can take these things with us. Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the teacher, the teaching, and the community, or everything. Everything is Buddha. But we do need a sense of, we do need at least an openness around accepting that the journey is not easy, that there is a poverty to it. I sometimes think of Zazen itself as mental fasting. It sort of feels like that, right? Like, oh, there's that daydream I always really love to have about, nope, not for 40 minutes, have it later, not right now. Oh, but I really want to polish the jewel of how anxious I am. later. But I'm so special if I... No, not me. Right? It's all about sense of self, a reinforcing sense of self, right? How central we are, how important. Not now. It's actually a very radical fasting, in a sense. In a way, you're fasting from yourself. Right? For 40 minutes, you actually don't get to indulge in being you. The teaching says you're not you. The teaching says you don't exist in any fundamental sense. So when you are distracted by you, just let that person go. They're not there. So there is a... And it's difficult, right? That's difficult. Because the you story is our favorite story. The me story is my favorite story. So it is fasting. And there is an ordeal component there. And this pushes us past our normal comfort zones. This is really when the work gets done. I saw the folks on the pilgrimage in France and Scotland when I was there years ago, and then more recently in Ireland, you know, the first couple days, you're all just happy to be there, and you're getting to know each other, and you're still very much in your normal social persona, right? So if back in the States, you're a doctor, you're still a doctor in Ireland, and you perhaps like to work that into conversation. Maybe you like to work that into conversation because you are a doctor. It might change the way you're perceived, right? Or you are a grandmother, or you are a whatever, right? But after a few more days, sharing rooms with somebody that you did not sign up to share a room with, being kept awake by perhaps the snoring of someone you did not choose to spend the day with, eating food you did not choose, going to places perhaps in the rain when you did not choose rain, you know how these little things start to erode away our normal, lovely, you know, and then we get to a place that's a little more real. A little more real. And of course the point isn't to try to wear people down and make them grouchy. That's not the point. Although that happens. The point is to get to see, and that's the way we do the teachings around these things, is to see, you know, in us, to see it when it comes up. Oh, I'm so irritable about that. Well, there it is, right? There's part of your defense. There's part of your thing. That's part of your accretions. That's part of self, right? Notice that. How can you notice it? Be nice to it. See it. Let it go. Right? That's when the practice becomes much more, from my way of looking at it, it becomes much more, in a sense, fertile. The same thing happens on retreat. You know, the first day, yeah, you can kind of coast. It's a little weird, but, yeah, you're doing your thing. Second day, third day, fourth day, you know, the back is really hurting now. I mean, now this is actually officially pain. And the knee and the person sitting next to you's loud breathing or the food not being brown rice, it's white rice or whatever, right? I mean, you're left alone with your devices to just trip out, and so you do. And you see your stuff come up, and it's like, oh, okay, good. Now we actually have something to work with. I mean, it's important for us to see what's under the veneer. You know, it's important for us to realize this is what practice does so efficiently. That nice layer we cover ourselves over with, gee whiz, that's not us. That's really not. And the thing that's underneath it, that irritable, that's actually not us either. Right? But we have to see it. We have to know what's motivating us. We have to be able to be friends with that to see it. Oh yeah, there it is, me being really grouchy at my neighbor for breathing too loud. That's the biggest problem in my life right now. This person's breathing too loud, and it's pretty damn serious. I've got 3 more days next to this person. What am I going to do? Wow. That's a great opportunity to see how we create, right? The drama of self, the drama of other, the horrible irritant. I mean, we're creating this. It's quite a fairy tale we have going in our heads. You know, unless I'm pushed past my normal comfort, I will never see that about myself. I will never watch my mind do that, right? If I was able to just get up and go, oh, I'm going to move. I'm just going to move. I'm going to move to a more comfortable chair, a more comfortable zendo, a community where nobody breathes. I will never come up against this problem. How lovely that would be. Oh, heavens. There's a great story about this. So there's a book. This is actually a James Joyce story, but it's being summarized in a book that I read called Zen Spirit, Christian Spirit by somebody named Father Kennedy Sensei. He's a Catholic priest, and he's one of the Dharma heirs of Bernie Glassman. Some of you know Bernie Glassman. He's a famous Zen teacher, and he's one of the founders of the Zen Peacemakers Order. And this guy's practices both Catholicism and Zen, so it's an interesting marriage. But anyway, he wrote a book called Zen Spirit, Christian Spirit, and he talked in these two paragraphs about poverty, and he did it really well, so I want to read it to you. In a short story by James Joyce in the collection Dubliners called Eveline, Joyce writes about a young woman living in a dying city with her family and friends. One day she meets a sailor who is very kind and manly and open-hearted. He has his peaked cap pushed back on his head and his hair tumbled forward over a face of bronze. He tells her of distant countries, ships, the Straits of Magellan, and stories of the terrible Patagonians. He also tells her that he has a home in Buenos Aires and that he wants her to come and be his wife. Eveline wants to go, to leave her home, to begin life anew in a distant and unknown country. And yet, as she is about to leave her old life, which is wearied, which has wearied her unspeakably, Eveline does not find her whole life wholly undesirable. She looks around the room, reviewing all of its familiar objects, which she has dusted once a week for many, many years. Perhaps she convinces herself she will never again see those well-worn possessions from which she has never dreamed of being divided. In her home, she has shelter and food, and in addition, she is surrounded by people she has known all her life. She wonders what they will say about her. Will they call her a fool for running off with this strange man? Eveline stands with the sailor among the swaying crowd at the docks. Through the wide doors of the sheds, she catches a glimpse of the black mass of the boat lying beside the dock. The boat blows its long, mournful whistle into the mist, and her resolution begins to slip away. Can she still draw back now after all he has done for her? Come, he says. A bell clangs, and the seas of the world tumble about her heart. Come, he calls, and she feels him seize her hand. No. She convinces herself she can't go. It is impossible. Her hands clutch the iron gate in frenzy. She sets her white face to him, passive and helpless. Her eyes give him no sign of love or recognition. She lacks the poverty of spirit needed for pilgrimage. She cannot give up, clinging to her old possessions, her old way, not even to go to her life. So that's, well, of course, that's a very sad story. In a sense, it is. I really get that, though. I really identify with her. I really do. We all know that. That's nothing new. How many things we say no to in life? Because we're scared. Because we're scared. That's all. Yeah, that's all. It's just that simple. So they talk about, you know, I remember reading a study once that said, that actually followed people getting on buses. I'm not sure how they would have arranged this study. But they said humans will, when getting on a bus, you will choose to sit next to somebody you know and do not like before you'll sit next to a stranger. They said, yeah, like 87% of the time or whatever, you will choose to sit next to somebody you don't like, but you know, as opposed to sitting next to a stranger. I went, oh, that's that story. She's choosing something that's of only minor satisfaction, but it's safe. You know, yeah, it could be hell, but it's familiar hell. She sweeps it. She wallpapered it. She knows it really well. It's in some way safe, right? As opposed to taking the leap into the unknown. And we do that all the time. That's part of how we, part of how we're so tempted to be. So poverty, letting go of that known, of that insulation, is really challenging. Really challenging. And we have to be very gentle with ourselves, right? We really do. We can't always sit next to the stranger. We can't leave with every man with a face of bronze who offers us a life in Buenos Aires, right? I'm just saying. But the lesson here, and of course the lesson, and it isn't that, you know, staying in the same place with the same person doing the same thing is death either. It isn't at all, you know. Buddhism is always about working with the mind, right? And there's a way in which she could stay in Dublin with her old life and see it afresh all the time, right? That it isn't a deadening routine. If routines were deadening, Zen practice would really be in bad trouble because we always do the very same thing in the very same way over and over and over and over until we're dead. Wonderful! That's our vehicle for liberation, right? So it isn't about the repetition. It's about the spirit, right, in which it's done. Which is why mindfulness, that aspect, is so important. You know, every time you take off your shoes is the first time. Every time you set down the car keys, that's the first time. You will never set them down that way again. You won't. You know, they're always reminding us, right, over and over. The breath you're taking right now is different than any other breath you have ever taken. You get one shot. That's it. Pay attention. Don't miss it. This is it, right? So because Zen is really a practiced religion, it's not a belief-based religion, it also involves us letting go oftentimes of our, you know, because belief is based on mental construct and past experience, right? Past experience, mental construct, that's what belief is. And Zen is kind of inviting us to, I want to say let them go entirely, which, yeah, but at least hold them very lightly. Right? Your past experience, your mental constructs do give you a helpful sort of bullet point version of what your interpretation of what might have happened is. Right? Which is useful. I mean, today when you go home, it's a good idea to know where that is. Right? That's a belief based on past experience. But at the same time, to think that you know that place, that you know the people who share that space with you, that would be a mistake. Right? Because you don't. That place is new. When you go home today and walk in your door, you're doing it for the first time. It's different than you've ever done it before. Right? You have different thoughts. You have different feelings in your heart. There are different things moving in you. You're walking into that space in a brand new way. And the invitation to Zen is to not miss that. Right? Let go of your old ideas about it. Walk into it empty-handed, right? That's the radical poverty of Zen. Just walk into it empty-handed. And then, of course, you're awake to it. You're awake to it. So in Zen, the poverty is about letting go of knowing and having and possessing and clinging. Right? It doesn't have to be a literal poverty. My bank account is zero. That's not what we're saying. It's about our attaching and our clinging and our defining those things as the things that keep us safe. Because they don't. Because they really don't, ultimately. So I think I'll finish talking about poverty by quoting the book again. Kennedy Sensei says some really cool things about poverty. So he says, I would define poverty as purity of heart. That's interesting to me. It actually kind of has a Christian flavor to me to it. I would define poverty as purity of heart, the ability not to protect the self, to project the self onto the other. Right? So, you know, guys understand projection in psychology, right? How you make everything about you. Everybody does it, right? But, you know, the world is a reflection of us. And we project ourselves onto it unconsciously. And so we're always viewing things through our lens, right? So I like you or I don't like you based on what you can do for me. Right? So that's not me seeing reality. That's me seeing Martin's current vision or opinion of reality. Right? What I like, what I don't like. We're projecting ourselves all the time onto reality. The ability not to project the self onto the other. Jesus said, the pure of heart will see God. Indeed, the pure of heart, those who do not project, are the only ones who ever see anything. The rest of us, those who do project, only see ourselves everywhere. Sometimes we lack the purity of heart needed for pilgrimage. In order to go on pilgrimage, we must be willing to be so poor that we neither need nor seek even temporary shelter. Pilgrimage demands a poverty so complete that we have nothing to lose, a poverty so freeing that we can step out into the larger world. Life demands of all of us radical poverty. We are to be so poor that we do not know even the matter of our own pilgrimage, so poor that we have nothing to cling to, so poor that we have nothing to project onto others, so poor that we have no shelters in the storm, no parallel life to escape to. And this poverty leads us to the deepest intimacy of all. That's really beautifully said, I think. When we stop making the world about us, when we stop projecting our own self, our own needs onto the world, we can see it as it really is. This poverty can lead us to the deepest intimacy of all. That's what I saw people do in these experiences that I've had, and that's what I hope for the folks who travel to South Africa as well, is that it starts as travel and then that stops, and then it becomes sightseeing and then that stops. And then it's sort of like going to a zoo where you're watching everything through this imaginary distance between you and other. Does that make sense, right? Like, oh, I get it. This is the exhibit called Ireland. Oh, and it's green, and there's, you know. But at some point, when we let go of those things, when we're brought past our comfort zone, when we're kind of forced into the places we wouldn't normally go, We watch how the old version of self doesn't work. It gets in the way. It causes us suffering. And if only for a few moments, at a few different places, people are really invited into a radical poverty. You know, they're hundreds of miles from their house. They're hundreds of miles from their loved ones. They're away from all that is normal to them. And all of a sudden, they find a connection to a place or a thing or a person that's completely unexpected. And really, they get pierced. You can sort of see it, that they're just moved and connected in a way that they would never have normally been. It goes past their ideas. It goes past their ideas. It's essentially kind of like being forced to sit next to that person on the bus. You just don't know, and maybe for the first few days you don't even like them. By the end, because of the circumstances, right, the container in which you are, you go to another place together. And I've experienced that during sesshin. You know, the person who's driving me crazy on day 3 with their breathing, by day 7, you know, especially during the end of the retreat, I'm almost weeping in gratitude because they sat next to me upright and they supported me that whole time. They were just there. And when I couldn't sit, they were there. And I would make it back somehow, you know. Time for the next sitting. Oh, there's no way. They're going to kill me with this thing. But there they were, already on their zafu, sitting up straight, breathing loud. Right? Wow. They were my bodhisattva. They were the one who was there with me, right? We never talked, but at the end of the week, you just want to hug them because you went to someplace, right? There's something really beautiful about that. So that leads us to the third element, which is connection, which is intimacy, and we do talk about this a lot in Zen. That's what we're here to do. That's what the practice is about. We call it availability to experience. We call it beginner's mind. We call it intimacy. We call it connection. We call it unity. We call it whatever we call it. But our practice, our silent practice, our sometimes solitary practice, is what leads us to connection with everything, right? Connection is actually what we always start off every pilgrimage looking for. Regardless of what the word is, that's what we all really want, right? That experience of being alive, experience of being connected, experience of being awake, of not being alone. Just simple connection. It's so simple. And Dogen says in his very famous passage from Genjo Koan, to study the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be intimate and connected to all of life. So to study the self is to forget the self. There's our not knowing. There's even the radical poverty. To forget the self is the most radical poverty we can possibly be invited to. And what does he say? That's what happens. He says the same thing that Father Kennedy does. To forget the self is to be connected to all of life. That's our pilgrimage. That's our goal. That's what we want, that intimacy, to be awake to what already is, the undividedness that our life already is. And the neat thing about this translation, there's a bunch of different translations of that Dogen passage. To forget the self is to be connected with all of life. The reason I like that is because the other word they oftentimes use is to forget the self is to be enlightened. Enlightened by all things, right? So these translators are, I don't know if it's intentional, but they're drawing an equivalency between enlightenment, right, which is the big buzzword that we use in Buddhist circles. That's the, we all know, that's the biggie that we all want. They're drawing an equivalency between enlightenment and just connection, intimacy. None of us know what intimacy looks like or what connection even is going to feel like because it's different, right? It's different with every person. It's different with every setting. It's different in every moment. We all have lots of concepts and ideas about what enlightenment would be. Oh, enlightenment. I'll never suffer again. And I'll be 50 feet tall and made of gold and I'll walk a foot off the ground. Lots of ideas about enlightenment. Well, they get in the way. So to the extent you're able, please adopt a stance of radical poverty toward your ideas of that kind of stuff. Use the word intimate instead. Isn't that nice? You know, the intimacy you have with your best friend is a completely different flavor than the intimacy you have with your folks or your cat or your tea kettle. Right? It's different. Of course, it's shifting all the time. It isn't something you arrive at. It isn't a place you get to stay. It's shifting and changing. But that's a wonderful way of working with that word, that enlightenment and intimacy are the same thing. Something nice. And the lovely thing about that, from my point of view, is that that connection, that intimacy isn't later. It doesn't have to happen when we're perfect. Right? I like to think that enlightenment happens to me when I'm perfect. Good luck. Intimacy, though, oh, I can actually have that. In all of my delusion and all of my brokenness and all of my misguided Martinness, I can still feel an honest-to-God connection, right, with family, with friends, with cats, with tea kettles. Those things are real to me. I can touch them. I can really be open to them. Well, there it is, right? There it is. There's my pilgrimage. There's my openness. There's my enlightenment. And that's going on all the time. So Buddha's enlightenment isn't 2,500 years ago. And Buddha's enlightenment isn't in 5 or 7 years after you're really serious about Zazen and you really get good at it. It isn't waiting around the corner for you. No. Right now, Buddha's enlightenment is. It's yours, right? It is your enlightenment, and it is now. And the invitation is always to return. Wake up. Open. Right? It is here. It is now. It is going on. That's the promise. That's the promise of practice. And every time we allow ourselves to come back to this unknowable unfolding, we do this perfectly. You can't fail at it. You do it. Every time you let go and come back, there it is. It's perfect right there. There's connection, there's intimacy, and it's perfect. And you release yourself into everything. You release yourself into everything, and there's no separation. No separation, right? At all. In just that moment, no separation. You know, pow, you're home again. So, and we have an infinite number of moments to do that, over and over. So that's the wonderful thing. That's the wonderful thing. An infinite number of chances. So, that's it, I think. Those are my thoughts today. Those are my thoughts today on pilgrimage. And if you are not moved to travel to a foreign land with a backpack, I invite you to use your walk later today down to Dun Brothers or around the lake or back to your car as your pilgrimage. It's not where you go, it's how you do it. So when you go home today to your apartment or your cat or your tea kettle, just remind yourself of that. There's an opportunity there for awakening. We have a minute or two, I suppose, if anybody has any comments or questions or complaints. Anybody have anything to say? Yeah.
Where are you going? That's up.
Oh, it's, well, South Africa, I'm, we're still in the planning stages. We are planning to take 30 folks. We have now filled about 26 of those spots, so we're still looking for a handful more people. It's in conjunction with the Aslan Institute where I work. Lyndall Johnson's the president there of the, it's a mental health and wellness clinic in Egan, for those of you who don't know. It's a collection of folks who are therapists and energy workers and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, she really likes to do that, and I ended up getting kind of roped in with this. I shouldn't say it that way because it was my idea. I have a way of roping her into this. I'm not sure how it works, but I have found it to be very good practice. It's extremely challenging. I do not like it. I'll just tell you, I do not like it at all. But, you know, I feel that way about Zazen sometimes too, right? So it's all good. But yeah, this will be in March of 2004. We're hoping to take 30, like I said, about 30 people. And we'll spend... Oh, I'm sorry, 2014, yes. 2014, about 30 folks, and we'll be there about 2.5 weeks. We'll be in South Africa the whole time. We're going to go to Cape Town, Johannesburg. We're going to visit Robben Island Prison. I'm very excited about that. That's where Nelson Mandela was held. The theme, they have a theme, the way we're doing it. The theme of this is truth and reconciliation, you know, forgiveness. How do we work with that? So it's pretty gritty. You know, South Africa's history is just unimaginably wretched, really, really painful. So this has a little bit of a different energy around it for me as a Zen practitioner. What I'm hoping is to spend a lot of time with the three tenets of the Buddhists or of the Zen Peacemakers Order that Lee Lewis gave a talk about. Not knowing, right? Not knowing, bearing witness, being willing to see what we don't want to see, bearing witness, They do bearing witness retreats in some Buddhist traditions. They go visit Dachau, and they just do their session there for a week. They just look at it. You don't need to do anything, but you need to see it, right? And then healing is the third tenet, to heal self and others. You know, that's our bodhisattva vow, to help people. So, we've adopted a little village there. We're sending supplies to, medical stuff, school supplies, that kind of stuff. So it has an outreach component to it, but it's just about getting a bunch of people, putting them in a container that's going to be interesting, and encouraging them to use that time to do some pretty serious spiritual work. Did that answer your question? Yeah. Yeah. Ask me when we're about 2 months away from it how I'm feeling about it, and you'll get a very interesting answer.
Marty.
Yes?
In my mind, the idea of going on a pilgrimage is kind of tied up with the idea of going to a sacred place.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can address that. Is that something that's helpful, or is that something that can be a hindrance to practice?
Ooh, Ted, that's a good question. I think it is helpful. I think it is helpful. That's a good question, because it kind of ties in with our not knowing, that we have expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what is Pipestone going to be? It's a sacred place. It's going to feel a certain way. It's going to look a certain way. That's a good question. One of the things, this is just based on my experience, so I don't know if this would be the same for everybody. But if I go to a place, and when I go to places that were constructed with tremendous intentionality, they were designed and built according to sacred geometry with a huge amount of intention. These are designed and set apart as places of prayer, peace, whatever. I usually feel it. And I don't know how much of that is in my head. I don't know if that's morphic resonance. I don't know what weird word about that. A lot of people talk about, and you know what's funny is I've heard people say that about this place. I really have. People said, this building wasn't built as a Zen center. It wasn't built as, this is going to be a little oasis of peace on Lake Calhoun, right? But it has been for 40 years. And so I think I feel it when I'm here. People talk about how, this was the dining room at one point, but it's sure not anymore. You know, this place is full of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. It's been this way for 40 years. People have, with great intention and great courage, been just sitting and working, doing the work of spiritual practice to transform their lives, and it becomes a sacred place. So I think going into it with that idea, I think that can be helpful. That's a great question, Tim. On the other hand, when I first came here, I drove by the place 3 different times because I did have an idea in my head that a Zen Buddhist temple must look like a Zen Buddhist temple, whatever that is. So I figured it was the big gold dome over here. That's not the Zen center. That's the Greek Orthodox Church. And so I was like, it's a house? Oh, man. So, yeah, preconceived idea. Yeah, it's a dance always, isn't it? Oh, well, thank you. We're running low on time, so thank you all very much.